Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Emily Dufton, the host of this channel, and today we'll be talking to Dr. Lucas Rickert about his new book, Strange Trips: Science, Culture, and the Regulation of Drugs, which was released earlier this year by McGill-Queen's University Press. Rickert is the George Erdong Chair in the History of Pharmacy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the Historical Director of the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy. He's also co-editor of the journal Social History of Alcohol and Drugs. Strange Trips is his second book. Luke, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So before we discuss your new book, I was wondering if you could begin by telling us a bit about yourself. What got you interested in studying drugs?
Oh, wow. Okay. So I started my journey, I guess, as a writer and a historian, mostly thinking about pharmaceuticals. And then I veered off and I wanted to dive deeper maybe into how some drugs, whether or not it's painkillers or other over-the-counter pills, might be considered legit or how others might be, breaking bad, if you can put it that way. So I've been tinkering on the ideas and strange trips for quite a long while. And a bit about myself, if you'll indulge me, is
of course.
in the past few years, I've been bouncing around from Canada to Glasgow and then now in Madison. So all that's just to say that the title of this book, Strange Trips, I think it's a pretty accurate description of my life too. So as I was writing it, I was kind of going through a strange trip myself.
Well, they say write what you know. So I think this is very appropriate. What I loved about Strange Trips is that it covers a lot of terrain, and I think some interesting terrain that I don't read about in a lot of other books. So before we get into the nitty gritty, can you give listeners a 30,000 foot view of what your book is about?
Yeah, happy to provide the Coles Note version. That's the easy part. So, Strange Trips, it's really quite simple, I guess, at its core when you strip everything away, when you take away all the gloss. It's at its heart, it's about why we control and regulate drugs in the U.S. and Canada. It's about our shared beliefs and maybe right or wrong assumptions about drugs, and then how these impact health and society. So, look, ideas about drugs are transmitted through culture, whether or not it's television and movies, and then science and medicine help us make decisions. And on top of that, political ideology has a major part to play. So,
right.
When, what I try to do in the book is show some of the linkages between the science and the medicine, and the culture. And, to go even a bit further, drugs move, whether or not it's cannabis, which you know tons about, drugs move. they take trips. They take trips themselves from being illegal and illegal, from being legit to illegitimate. They move from being accepted and praised to being cast out and demonized. And so what I try to do in the book is show how the a variety of different drugs take trips and show that movement.
Absolutely. So Strange Trips is such an appropriate title for it. And I really appreciated how you did weave in discussions of popular culture, films, things like that, along with political rhetoric and scientific discussions about these substances as well. I think kind of having that interdisciplinary approach to it is so useful and would encourage anyone listening who's writing a drug history to do the same, because it really gives a better, thorough embrace of the history. It's true. We can't talk about drugs without talking about culture.
I promised myself that I was going to weave in Mr. T into any book that I wrote in the future. And luckily I fulfilled that promise to myself.
Oh, congratulations. He was one of my childhood heroes. So I was thrilled to see him appear. I'd also like to know more about the choices you made behind your writing, the behind the scenes, if you will. So as you said before, you're interested primarily in pharmaceuticals, and Strange Trips follows that up by focusing primarily on licit drugs, or at least the licit uses of drugs, even if those drugs themselves are technically illicit. And you mostly look at medical uses of drugs for killing pain or for losing weight or for aid in psychotherapy, things like that. You don't necessarily look at recreational use or use for pleasure. Could you explain why you chose to focus on licit rather than illicit use?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think ultimately I chose to interrogate the back and forth and the push and the pull of, you know, how substances start out as licit and then move to a different realm or different sphere and then back again. That choice, I reckon, started with a book, as most things do in the world of history. And I don't know if you've come across Susan Califf's kick-ass book called Nature's Path.
No.
It's a history of naturopathic healing in America. She's based in California. She's a feminist. She's an activist. In the course of her book, which I really like, she walks the reader through alternative health movements. Today, we know all sorts of things about alternative health movements, whether or not it's Gwyneth Paltrow and Goop or New Agey stuff or yoga and acupuncture and whatever else. But as I was writing my book, Califf kept popping into my brain over and over again. She, I think, did a masterful job in underlining the longevity of how, you know, doctors and quote unquote outsiders and regulators and patients have negotiated the proper, the right kind of treatments. And that's never been a straightforward linear process. Hmm. And so I deliberately chose to start my chapters within the legitimate medical realm, but then try and highlight how and why they move or take trips, as I said earlier. So what are the factors involved? You know, who are the key players? And then try and link that history to some of the contemporary discussions.
That's great. That's really great. I also really liked how Strange Trips was divided into three sections. In the first, you kind of focus at the end, right? You go to end of life palliative medicine. Mm-hmm. In the second, you focus on what you call hippie medicine. And in the third, you discuss what you call demonized pharmaceuticals. So I do want to talk more about the specific drugs you focus on in these sections. But before we do, why these three themes? How did you choose them?
Super good question. I guess just taking a step back for a second, lots of really awesome books and some crappy books about drugs examine just one drug. And so what I tried to do is present a broader perspective and explore various different substances and then put them into conversation with each other, right? So that's what I'm trying to do in the book. So there's got to be a way of organizing the different drugs. So the themes I reckon sort of bubbled to the surface in an organic sort of way. And it seemed maybe more unique to me, at least, to organize them around certain themes than just telling a straightforward chronological story.
Mm-hmm. And did the drugs themselves give you the themes? Were there certain drugs that you picked because you wanted to focus on them and you realized you could group them specifically in these ways? Or did you go in thinking about the groups and then choose the drugs?
No, I didn't think about the groups beforehand. It just seems, it seemed like patterns emerged as I interrogated the different substances and drugs. And at the same time, I wanted to offer sort of a fresh spin or fresh take on an analysis of different substances. So I see the themes as sort of a groovy map. If you can, you know, wrap your head around that. So the end of life section deals with opiates and lesser known substances, Littrill. The demonized pharmaceuticals section deals with diet pills and then Canadian pharmaceutical products that are shipped to the U.S. and hippie medicines, which is, I should say that I'm not being negative or pejorative when I say hippie medicines. That's about LSD and cannabis. And so,
which are just so closely associated with the 60s counterculture. I had no problem and did not find it insulting at all. But I did appreciate right. I did appreciate the Canadian spelling of hippie, H-I-P-P-Y, as opposed to the American spelling, H-I-P-P-I-E. I thought that was very charming. I liked it.
Oh, one of many differences between our great countries.
Yes. Well, speaking of that, though, I'm fascinated by the geographic locations of this book. Now, this might be, and perhaps listeners can hear in your accent, that you are Canadian yourself. Where are you from in Canada?
The city's called Saskatoon in the province of Saskatchewan. I dare you to say that fast.
I will take your challenge sometime when I'm not being recorded. But so much of Strange Trips deals with U.S.-Canadian relations and the role of drugs in Canada and even medical tourism between the states and our neighbor to the north. And I love this perspective because not only do I really do love Canada, but also because
thanks.
I don't. Oh, it's a, you're also wonderful. There's so few of you. There's only 32 million Canadians, but you're also great. But also because I just feel like Canada doesn't get enough attention from drug historians. Can you discuss why you chose to focus on Canada and what role does Canada play in international drug policy?
So I wasn't trying to fill a gap when it came to Canada, to be fair. So it wasn't a conscious choice. I find the relationship between the two countries incredibly fascinating, especially now that I'm living in the U.S.
Mm.
I try to show in Strange Trips how national, local, and international policies can diverge across time and space. And so even when policies are analogous, maybe they're enforced very differently. And so relationships between humans and drugs, regulators and the public are overwhelmingly dependent on context. So Saskatoon obviously is not the same as San Francisco, but a lot can be learned about microanalyses of Saskatoon drug policy. Just as a lot can be learned from a study of countercultural forces in San Francisco. So more than that, when you place the two countries alongside each other, and when you try and interrogate some of the similarities and differences, I reckon it lends fresh perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think Canada is fascinating because in some ways it has this incredibly progressive approach to drug policy, right? You have federally legalized cannabis in the United States is still going by this piecemeal state-by-state approach. And yet you remain essentially a commonwealth of the United Kingdom. Am I getting that correct?
Sure. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So how does this function? And how, like, why do you think Canada has this very progressive approach to certain substances? Of course, in, you know, Vancouver, you have Insight, one of the only legally recognized supervised injection sites in North America. You have legalized cannabis. You're doing a lot of things that are remarkably, one might say, avant-garde as far as drug policy is concerned. And yet you have this very interesting, you know, governmental relationship with another country. You're the neighbor to the north of the United States, which does not have such progressive drug policies. Where does Canada sit in a global drug policy scheme? And why do you think it's so unique?
I'm not sure. That's a nuanced question. I guess the first thing I'd say is I think we have loads of troubles with drug policy in Canada still that need to
it's
be sorted
perfect.
Out.
You're ruining my image of Canada.
I know. Oh. Sorry. I'm so sorry. The dreams are shattered. That's the last thing I wanted to have happen today. So there are positives and negatives when it comes to how Canadian jurisdictions, whether or not it's in British Columbia or elsewhere, are tackling the opioid crisis. At the federal level, the Liberals decided to embark on this experiment of legalization of cannabis. Medical cannabis has been around since 2001. But I mean, you have to remember that legalizing cannabis at the national level is still a violation of federal law. Sorry, excuse me, international law, mm-hmm. not federal law, international law. And that's also something that the United States needs to grapple with. In terms mm-hmm. of the breadth and the scope of the two countries, I mean, I'm not a political scientist, and I'm kind of on thin ice here when I say this, but... I think in the U.S., just the breadth of the country and the size, the different states doesn't lend itself necessarily to, you know, a unified approach to drug policy in the same way that Canada, which is vastly smaller population-wise, would.
I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. I mean, the population of Canada is smaller than the population of California, which does make for more complicated policy matters and decision making when it comes to determining, you know, entire federal scope of the entire federal scope of certain substances. But to move away from Canada, our beautiful, beloved Canada, and to get more into the nitty-gritty of the drugs you focus on in your book, which is why we're here, I thought the first section on palliative medicine had two really intriguing protagonists that you had mentioned a couple of minutes ago, and those are heroin and latreille. So in your book, both of these drugs are concerned primarily with cancer treatment and care. And I was wondering if you could walk us through their histories as cancer medicines. How does the history of heroin intersect with the history of cancer?
So these parts of the book are quite personal, actually. And writing them was sort of a cathartic experience in a lot of ways. My mom died after a protracted struggle with cancer. In doing so, she took a number of strange trips herself, mentally, physically. So she was kind of at the heart of this section of the book. This section of the book is, as you said, it's about the types of drugs that we might take and might want to take at the end of our existence. What should we be allowed to take? Why or why not? We're on our way out the door, so to speak. So should we get to decide? So I use medical heroin and latrille as a way to try and unpack these fairly large questions about access and choice in the medical marketplace. So medical heroin, I try and explore it through case studies of Canada and the U.S. I examine why Canada would legalize heroin as a palliative treatment on a limited basis, mind you, and why the U.S. wouldn't. Mm-hmm. Why would heroin be more effective, arguably, than morphine or Dilaudid? Who are the sort of key physicians and major players who were in support of medical heroin, and why or why not? A big part of the story has to do with the rise of palliative care. I don't know if you've come across Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's On Death and Dying. It's a 1969 book, so 50 years, pretty important. It's a great book. She studies how humane medical treatments emerged in the late 1960s. She outlines the various stages of griefs. And so what I try to do is make these sort of bring these two ideas together, the rise of palliative care and what kind of drugs we should be using.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And it's so interesting, these conversations about what sort of drugs we should use at the end of our lives. Because as you say, you know, we're heading out the door, the fear for dependency or addiction seems small, since even if the person does live slightly longer, without pain, that would be a good thing, right? You would assume that would be a good thing. They're probably not going to overcome this cancer and go on to become a heroin addict. The chance of that is probably pretty small. And yet there is a lot of that same fear of addiction and of drug dependency driving the anti-heroin feelings in the United States, preventing it from being used as a medicine in palliative care, which I think is fascinating. Could you talk a little bit about the fear of heroin as a demon drug and why it prevented the embrace of heroin in palliative care in the U.S.?
It's kind of a quirky argument to make when you think about it. The idea that someone who has a finite amount of time left shouldn't get addicted to a substance. I mean, it just kind of stretches credulity in a lot of ways that that people would use that. But at the same time, you had a variety of other folks in the United States who were suggesting that if you legalized heroin in palliative care, that it might leak out of the hospital, that the cabinets might be broken into and it might hit the streets. And you have to remember that in the late 1970s, 1980s, you have a lot of fears about heroin misuse. And so the idea of sort of heroin in sterile palliative settings informing drug addicts in major urban centers is a very real thing.
Is heroin a useful drug in palliative care? And did your mother try it at all?
No, she didn't. And whether or not it's useful, it's been used in a variety of medical contexts. So the British Medical Association never stopped using it in end of life treatment, and that was the basis on which the Canadian Medical Association decided to once again allow heroin back into these settings. So throughout the chapters, what I try to do is get to grips with to the different arguments that were made for its effectiveness and utility, its solubility, how quickly it breached the blood-brain barrier, mm-hmm. and whether or not it was ultimately riskier than, say, morphine.
It's really interesting stuff. The other drug that you address in that first section on palliative care is latril, and I did not know very much about this. I was wondering if you could tell listeners what it is and why it was and remains so controversial.
Yeah, wow. Latril was a fascinating chapter to write in the book. Okay. It can be found, latril can be found all over the globe in, so it's naturally occurring. It's in such foods as almonds or chickpeas, cashews, barley, and...
In, I'm guessing, very small, minute amounts, or...
Right.
And I mean, how many cashews would I have to eat to cure my cancer?
How much can you afford? It's pricey.
That's true.
Yeah. There's certain levels of toxicity with latril, and you distill it, and it's promoted as a cancer treatment. And it goes back hundreds, if not thousands of years, really. And so in the 1970s, one of my favorite times to write about, it emerged as a popular alternative medicine. And it, I suppose, crystallized debates, if you will, about consumer choice and government intrusion in the medical marketplace, and then the availability of certain drugs, like we already spoke about with heroin, right?
Mm-hmm.
So... latril, I suppose, embodied in a lot of ways the growing influence of patient activist groups.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a variety of cancer groups. One that comes to mind is the International Association of Cancer Victims. Another one might be the Cancer Control Society. These were organizations that had some hardcore supporters, and they used tenets of the natural and alternative health movements that stretch back to the 1960s, late 1950s, and they played up failings of medical institutions, and they really underlined how crappy the government was at offering cures for cancer, right? So this was a moment that saw the emergence of a really sort of robust network of activists, and they were critiquing what they saw as outmoded or... orthodox treatments like chemo or morphine, and these folks who pushed latril often possessed pretty conspiratorial views. They often had neoconservative ideals. They would castigate the Food and Drug Administration, the National Cancer Institute, for being really poor at their jobs.
Hmm. Which is so interesting, right? That it would be these sort of neocons who are suggesting that that the American Cancer Institute and things like that are not doing a good enough job, so they go to essentially hippie medicine.
Right.
I think you write repeatedly in your book that drug choices make odd bedfellows out of really strange, diverse groups. And I think latril is a really fascinating example of bringing groups that you would not necessarily group together, in any other context together, battling for essentially personal choice, and ownership of one's own cure and one's own health. which I think is the theme throughout your book. And I want to talk a little bit about that in a minute, that sort of larger idea. But it also applies to a section you talk about in, or a phenomenon, I should say, you talk about in the third section, demonized drugs, which is medical tourism, but not, mm-hmm. I think, where most listeners would associate medical tourism, like going to Mexico, as you talk about when you discuss Dallas Buyers Club or people who travel to Europe or Asia to have cheaper surgeries. But you're talking about medical tourism between the United States and Canada and what happens after 9/11. But again, it's people trying to take things into their own hands and choosing to pursue their own cures. How does that happen between the US and Canada? What does medical tourism look like in North America?
So because we have price controls when it comes to prescription medicines in Canada, a lot of Americans, to help out their pocketbooks, want to buy drugs from Canada, right? It's and so it's taken a couple of forms. You can, in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, you could hop on a bus that was sponsored by the AARP, the American Association for Retired People, drive across the border. And you know, pick up some prescriptions, or on the flip side, instead of going to a brick and mortar pharmacy in Manitoba or Saskatchewan or wherever else, you could just order online. Mm-hmm. So you could engage in these online pharmacies. So it's that kind of virtual tourism. So sometimes real tourism and virtual tourism that helps Americans deal with exorbitant drug prices.
Can't even imagine being on one of those AARP sponsored buses heading up to Canada. That must be, quite the trip, you know?
I can't imagine the partying that's going on those buses.
Oh man, you know, it's nonstop until maybe 7:30 PM when everyone goes to sleep. To follow up really quickly on our discussion of Latril, what is the current legal status of this drug?
So the Food and Drug Administration in 1980, determined that it was not safe or effective. And so what that did, obviously, is it drives it underground. And so there's still, as far as I know, sort of a black market for this, and Americans could go elsewhere for Latril if they wanted. They could travel to Mexico or further afield.
That's so fascinating to me, especially as a historian, because, as you know, in my book Grassroots, I talk a lot about the history of marijuana as a substance that moves back and forth between legality and illegality and back again.
And great book, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you. We had a great conversation about it a couple of weeks ago for New Books Network. and I used to think, you know, patting my own back, wow, what a unique argument in terms of pot. But your book shows me precisely how wrong I was, and that lots of drugs swing on this pendulum between legality and illegality, illicit and illicit uses. I mean, if you're talking about heroin in terms of underground use is one thing, heroin in terms of medical use at end-of-life palliative care is something completely different. Latril in America is illegal, and in Mexico it's not. Can you discuss this tension, this pendulum that drugs swing on within your book, and why do you think these drugs move back and forth so often?
Ooh, that's super hard. The first thing I suppose I would say is that we should probably recognize how drugs have been integral to the formation of society and civilizations, as well as helping define cultural identities and norms. And various drugs have underpinned the growth of the world economy. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, humans have been using psychoactive substances, whether or not it's heroin or cannabis, for thousands of years. So we should probably make that statement and plant that flag right off the bat. Evidence from across pre-modern world indicates that all sorts of substances, whether or not it's wine or peyote or whatever else, tea leaves, for a host of medicinal, recreational and religious purposes have been used, right? So that's one thing. So the second thing has to do with modern science and how we regard science and medicine in today's society. I don't want to get too deep or anything, but the way I try to treat science in the book is as a fluctuating or fluid sort of intermediated process. And it's one that's hyper political. So in looking at in the different drugs, I think my book demonstrates that this process helps give shape in concert with culture, give shape to the way the drugs move back and forth. Now about the whole science thing, just because it's fluid and intermediated doesn't mean I have less faith in it or anything, but I think as historians, we need to be aware of sometimes its fallibilities in giving shape to drug policies, as well as all its magnificent strengths. but look, those involved in the debates about drugs becoming legitimate and illegitimate are not going away anytime soon. So patient activists from the 1970s are around today. Those patient consumers are still here. And they're still going to push boundaries, and they're still going to resist the government. They're going to still attempt to revolutionize medicine. And look, we're seeing that right now with CBD and with vaping technologies.
And the use of psychedelics in, and, you know, mental health treatment. It's
absolutely, it's yeah.
The way that drugs inspire people to, you know, take to the streets and to fight for what they want, I think is such a fascinating thing, which is why I think Grassroots and Strange Trips are almost sibling books in a way, talking about how regular people have really pushed to change laws, and if not laws, at least access to certain substances, because they believe that they need it to improve the quality of their lives. And that's, you know, that... I love an activist.
Yes.
So what was your favorite drug or phenomenon, drug-related phenomenon, to write about in Strange Trips?
I had a lot of fun researching and writing about the diet pills. I enjoyed the preliminary research on ketamine at the very end of the book. The final chapter is called A Ketamine Coda. Let's see.
Can you describe what ketamine is for our listeners?
Oh, ketamine is a hallucinogen anesthetic, and it's used in all sorts of party settings, and it's also being used now as an adjunct to psychotherapy. So if someone is suffering from treatment-resistant depression and standard products, SSRIs are not doing it, then now you can go for ketamine treatments. But it's also important to recognize that it's, you know, an underground club drug that's been known as Special K for quite a long time.
Right. Another perfect example of a drug that swings on that pendulum between licit and illicit uses, and has certain places where it is approved of and used in clinical settings, and other places where it's, you know, very clearly a recreational substance. Completely fascinating. And what drug do you think went on the strangest trip historically in your book?
If you dig deep enough, all the drugs in the book went on bizarro journeys. And why I think they matter in understanding those the journeys is that we're seeing that right now with, as you said, Emily, the psychedelics, magic mushroom legislation in California, opioids, vaping. But I guess if I had to pick one, if you're making me pick one, it would have to be the...
And I am, yes.
Yeah. Pick one. The history of heroin in Canada is one that just... When I was looking at the documents in the archives and I was writing, it just... I had a hard time going to sleep because I just wanted to keep writing about it. And I think it's an incredibly layered story also that adds to... the opioid crisis that we're going through right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's hard to read anything that's not super fascinating about heroin. I 100% agree with you. And I really liked looking at it within palliative care in that chapter in your book. I thought that was a really useful addition to larger understandings of the rise of the opioid crisis and how, because people were concerned with an undertreatment of pain, that was why we had Purdue Pharma, you know, promoting OxyContin and things like that. You know, we have not been treating cancer pain well enough. Well, here's a whole other drug, because essentially we didn't use clinical heroin. So these pharmaceutical companies came in the 1980s and 90s and said, well, if you're not going to use that, here are these lovely pills. And look what it's gotten us into today. So I think your chapter is just such a useful sort of prelude to our current crisis. It's a more people should read it. Highly recommend it.
Thank you. Yeah.
In your conclusion, you write that, and this is a quote, the rise of the empowered patient consumer who purportedly knows what is best for him or herself and regards the physician in an instrumental manner forms a vital part of strange trips. I love that. I'm fascinated by this theme about the question of personal choice. And as you note, drugs and the people who support access or lack of access to them can make these really strange bedfellows, as we talked about before. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about the idea of personal choice and the empowered patient consumer in your book and the role that this person has played in determining drug policy?
Yeah, I think you really got to sort of the crux of the book. Personal choice matters, but facts matter. Getting proper treatment matters. So you have this ongoing tension where public health officials and physicians are frequently concerned that evidence underpins the management of a given substance, and that can be therapeutically or recreationally. Patients want to take ownership of their health. You get that. Patients crave facts. They crave knowledge. And sometimes they'll go online, which isn't necessarily the best place to go nowadays, to take ownership of their health. And so I guess in striving for medical facts, you see patients often set against or battling against doctors or lobbyists or public health officials and regulators. And the facts are really at the center. So the science often is far from settled. We talked a little bit about the science earlier, but the fact that the science isn't 100% conclusive has not prevented individuals from demanding access to and, you know, consuming unconventional or untested, unproven substances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's really at the core of the book, is that how that tension sometimes plays out. So let me just give you a very quick example, if I can. So,
sure.
Latril. So Latril, I already talked about, there were some really conspiratorial neoconservative folks who pushed Latril. They were suggesting that it was un-American and despotic that the Food and Drug Administration and the government prevented access to Latril. Hmm. They said it was a restraint on individual freedom.
Mm-hmm.
that, you know, this was kind of what a communist country would do in the 1970s. I find that incredibly off the charts interesting that these are the sorts of messages that patient activists would be using to get access to something.
Absolutely.
It's very Cold War. It's very anti-government. And it also relates to some of the debates we're seeing right now about the divide in the United States. So, look, sometimes patient empowerment is a good thing. Sometimes it isn't.
And that leads me to my next question, right? So I'm wondering if you can shift very quickly from historian to oracle, if you don't mind. It seems that the patient consumer is probably going to stick around for a while.
Yep.
So what effects do you see them having on the pharmaceutical marketplace? What do you think their impact is going to be on the future of prescription drugs?
Oh, wow. So apart from the patient consumer, I see a synergy, if you will, between patient consumer activism and companies recognizing that there may be certain problems in the medical marketplace. And so you have solutions that pop up. One solution, if you can call it that, is a company called GoodRx. I don't know if you've seen the commercials for them.
I've heard a bit about it, yeah.
So GoodRx is a startup company. There's a free website and a mobile app that tracks prescription drug prices and then offers you drug coupons all across the U.S. So this, you know, you've...
Good the things RX we have check. To do because we don't have price controls like Canada, right? We need apps and coupons. It's sad.
and so GoodRx looks at, I'm not sure the number, between 50 and 80,000 pharmacies across the U.S. and helps get you the best price. Mm-hmm. So that's one example of a response. Another example would be how major juggernauts in the American economic or industrial landscape are getting involved in prescription drugs. So Amazon has developed a mail order pharmacy.
Wow.
And it's relatively new and it's already facing some pushback from traditional pharmacies, whether or not it's CVS or whatever. You can read more in the Wall Street Journal. But in the years ahead, I think we're going to see new entrants into the pharmacy and prescription drug space, which is related to patient-consumer awareness of prices.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's going to be interesting for pocketbooks and for historians like you and me down the road.
But no more AARP bus trips up to Canada. I mean, GoodRx is going to render that obsolete. That's too bad.
I'm not sure if those are going to go away or not.
Oh, good. Okay, so there's still hope for when I retire. I can hop on a bus and head on up to. I'm sure I can heliport or a hologram of me can go to Canada by that time.
That's futuristic. Holy.
Right. I'm also shifting from historian to oracle. That's how I'm going to buy my drugs when I retire.
Nice.
Well, Luke, this has been great, but I know we've taken up a lot of your time and you have another book coming out in a couple of days. Do you want to mention the title of that very briefly?
Okay, sure. Yeah. That's called Break On Through, Radical Psychiatry and the American Counterculture. And it's coming out actually on the 8th, amazingly. I can't believe time is flying. And so that's just about mental health and psychiatry in the 1960s and 1970s.
Two books published in 1 year. You're making the rest of us look bad.
Promise I'm not on drugs.
But you could write about that in your next project. So actually, before we let you go, I would love to know what your next project will be. How many books are you going to publish in 2020? What are you working on next?
Well, I've been toiling away on a few projects. I guess the one I'm most excited about right now at this very second is something called Cannabis Global Histories. It's an edited collection, brings together some of the best new historical work on cannabis all across the planet. So there are chapters about Iran and Mexico and Israel and South America and the United States. And it's going to be awesome, I think, to expose readers to evidence-based stories about cannabis beyond the shores of North America, beyond Canada and the United States.
I think there's even going to be a chapter in that about the parent movement going abroad. I don't know who wrote it, though. That's too bad.
Yeah.
No, that was the book is based off of this fabulous conference that you organized at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow last year, where we all got together and discussed international cannabis history. And it was absolutely spectacular. It was such a good time.
It's going to be a trip to see that in print.
Yes. Anything else beyond that? Any other projects?
Oh, my goodness. What else? No, I got nothing else. That's it.
Take a break.
Yeah. I'm dialing it down.
Well, it all sounds awesome. And I want to thank you for writing Strange Trips. It's a fabulous book. I really can't recommend it highly enough. And I'd love to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed our conversation.
It was a pleasure.